Welcome to Cruise News, your daily update on everything happening at sea. Visit cruisenews.io to see today's stories and sign up for email alerts. We've got quite a mix in our deep dive today. We're looking at some really big strategic moves in the cruise world.
Definitely. It feels like the industry is looking way ahead, but also making some pretty immediate changes too.
Exactly. So first, we'll unpack the huge challenge of getting to net zero emissions. Then, something completely different, the excitement around a brand new Royal Caribbean International ship.
And finally, a really interesting policy shift from P&O Cruises that affects a couple of their well-known ships. It's quite the spread.
It really is. You've got the long-term environmental strategy, billions being invested there.
Right, securing the future, but then also reacting now to what travelers want. You know, new ships, different cruise options.
Okay, let's start with that big one, decarbonization. It's clear operators are looking at multiple fuels, not just one fix.
No silver bullet, that's for sure. Mm-hmm.
So for the ships being built right now, what's the go-to practical option that helps meet those near-term regulations?
Well, the clear frontrunner is liquefied natural gas, or LNG. That's what most new builds are designed for.
Okay, LNG. And that helps with the immediate goals, the IMO 2030 targets and such.
Exactly. Andreas Ulrich from RNA, they're a major classification society, checking ship safety and compliance, he confirmed this. LNG, especially if you can use drop-in fuels later, gives that essential interim relief. It gets them closer to the 2030 and even 2040 carbon goals.
Right, a bridge fuel. But what about the next step? I'm thinking methanol. We heard the new Disney Adventure is going to be methanol ready.
Yeah, methanol's definitely gaining traction.
But isn't that a bit of a gamble? Committing to a fuel where the supply chain isn't fully there yet? It needs special construction too, right?
It does. It's not compatible with standard fuel tanks. It needs different coatings, sometimes a pilot fuel. It adds complexity, no doubt.
So why do it now?
It's really a forward investment. Less a gamble, more planning. They're building ships, ready for a fuel supply they expect to become available. It shows they're serious about adapting long term.
Okay, that makes sense. Planning ahead. Now, speaking of supply issues, what about bio-LNG? In theory, it sounds perfect for existing LNG ships. Just drop it in.
It sounds perfect, yes. But the actual physical supply is really tight.
Why is that? What's the bottleneck?
It boils down to competition for the raw materials, the feedstock. The stuff needed to make bio-LNG. Power plants also need it desperately to make green electricity.
Ah, so shipping is competing with energy generation.
Precisely, which limits how much bio-LNG is actually available for ships.
So how do they get around that if they want to claim the green benefits? I heard about something called book and claim.
That's the workaround, the book and claim model.
Okay, explain that. It sounds a bit like creative accounting if the fuel isn't physically delivered to the ship.
It's not quite accounting. It's more of a mechanism to bridge the gap while supply catches up.
Yeah.
Basically, the bio-LNG gets produced somewhere and put into the main gas grid.
Okay.
Then the ship owner buys certified green certificates that prove that amount of green fuel was produced and its emissions were reduced.
So they buy the attribute of the green fuel, not necessarily the fuel itself.
Exactly. They can claim the emissions reduction for regulatory purposes.
Mm-hmm.
It supports the green fuel makers, but it avoids the impossible logistics of getting tiny amounts of physical bio-LNG to every single port right now. It's crucial for scaling things up.
I see. A clever way to make progress on paper and incentivize production, even if the pipes aren't connected yet.
Pretty much, yeah.
All right, let's look even further ahead. Hydrogen, often called the ultimate clean fuel. Why isn't that practical for big cruise ships today?
Logistics, mainly.
Yeah.
And energy density. RNA's Ulrich pointed this out, too. Hydrogen just takes up so much space to store the energy needed for a typical cruise.
So you'd lose passenger areas or just couldn't carry enough fuel?
Both, potentially. The tanks would have to be enormous, complex, heavily insulated. It would drastically change the ship design. Plus, you need a whole infrastructure for green hydrogen production. It's just not there yet for large passenger ships. It's more of a distant goal.
Okay, so if LNG is the bridge, methanol is the next step being built for, and hydrogen is way off. What can ships do right now for immediate impact while waiting for fuels?
That's where digitalization comes in. It's huge. Maria Garbarini, also from RNA, really stressed this.
Data analytics on board.
Yes. Smart systems managing everything, thousands of electrical components, optimizing how the engines run, hull cleaning schedules, even route planning based on whether to save fuel.
Real-time adjustments for efficiency.
Exactly. These measures can cut emissions significantly now. They deliver results today while the big fuel transition happens over decades.
But all this costs money. Retrofitting engines, installing new tech. There's a risk the tech becomes outdated quickly, too.
That's the economic challenge. Ulrich mentioned operators are hesitant. They need cost-effective options and reliable fuel supply chains before making massive investments.
So it really needs everyone working together. Cruise lines, governments, fuel companies.
Absolutely critical. Collaboration is key. No single company can solve the fuel supply and cost issues alone. It's too big, too complex.
Okay. A huge undertaking on the technical side. Let's switch gears now to something maybe a bit more immediately tangible for cruisers.
Market excitement time.
Yes. Royal Caribbean International. They've announced details for their third Icon-class ship, Legend of the Seas, launching July 2026.
And they're moving fast on this one. Construction at Meyer Turku Shipyard in Finland is actually running ahead of schedule, about 3 weeks ahead.
That's impressive. So July 2026 launch, where will she be sailing first?
She'll start in the Mediterranean for her inaugural season, sailing seven-night cruises out of Barcelona and also Civitavecchia, the port for Rome.
Nice med debut. And after that?
Then she heads across the Atlantic, repositioning to Fort Lauderdale in November 2026.
Ah, for Caribbean season. What kind of itineraries?
A mix. Six-night Western Caribbean and some longer eight-night Southern Caribbean trips. And here's a key point. Every single one of those Florida-based cruises includes a stop at their private destination, perfect day at CocoCay.
They're really leveraging CocoCay across the fleet, aren't they?
Definitely a major draw for them.
Now, Icon class means big thrills, big entertainment. What's the headline act debuting on Legend?
The big Broadway debut is Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, first time at sea in the main Royal Theater. Expect some pretty cool special effects for that one.
Willy Wonka at sea. Okay, what about the adrenaline stuff? Category 6 water park, I assume.
Oh, yeah, Category 6 is there. And for the real daredevils, the Crown's Edge ropes course. That's the one where you're dangling 154 feet above the ocean.
Wow. Part skywalk, part ropes course, part zip line. That sounds intense.
It definitely is.
Is Icon class still leaning more heavily on those high thrill attractions compared to, say, Oasis class? Or is it finding more balance?
It's still very focused on high impact experiences, that's fair to say. But they are also really diversifying. You've got other big venues like the Aqua Theater for water shows,
yeah.
The Absolute Zero ice rink for ice shows.
Right, so spectacle across the board.
Exactly. And then there's the dining. That's a huge focus too. 28 different places to eat or drink.
28? Okay, tell us about the new concepts. There are two really innovative ones, right?
Yes, two standouts. First, there's the Hollywoodland Supper Club.
Sounds glamorous.
It's meant to be. Think golden age of Hollywood. 1910s to 1950s vibe, gourmet food, cinematic decor, jazz music. It's designed as a whole immersive evening, not just a meal.
Okay, that sounds like a destination venue in itself. And the second one?
The second is the Royal Railway dining experience. On this ship, it's called Legend Station.
Royal Railway, like a train theme.
Sort of. It's an immersive five-course meal themed around Marco Polo's journey on the Silk Road. So the food takes you through different regions, China, India, Italy. Very specific, very themed.
Interesting. And they mentioned new casual spots, too.
Yep. In the Akadom Market area, there will be five new fast casual food stands. So lots of variety.
Clearly aiming for scale, but also unique quality experiences. Okay, for our last major piece of news, let's turn to P&O Cruises, a big change for two ships.
A really significant change, actually. They're ending the adults-only policy on Arcadia and Aurora after about two decades.
Wow, that's huge. So they'll be allowing families on board?
Yes, for select sailings starting in December 2026. It reflects that growing demand for multi-generational holidays we've seen since the pandemic.
So P&O is adapting its fleet strategy. When do these family sailings start, exactly?
Aurora's first all-ages cruise is set for December 11th, 2026. Arcadia follows 10 days later, December 21st, and bookings open up pretty soon, relatively speaking, October 2025.
Okay. And what kind of trips are we talking about? Are they putting families on the shorter runs or the classic longer voyages these ships are known for?
They seem to be integrating them fully. The itineraries include Northern Europe, the Med, the Canaries, even some really long ones. Like Arcadia has a 24-night Eastern Med cruise in August 2027. That will now be open to families.
24 nights with kids on a ship, previously adults only. Imagine this is getting some strong reactions from their loyal passengers.
Oh, definitely mixed reactions. You've got the longtime cruisers who loved that guaranteed, quiet, adults-only vibe. They're concerned, naturally.
Understandable.
But B&O is also saying they're hearing excitement from people who maybe cruised Aurora as kids themselves and now want to bring their own families. So two sides to it.
That's interesting context, but what's the practical reality for families? Are they adding kids clubs, water slides? What changes are being made to the ships?
This is the crucial point. There will be NO dedicated kids clubs or babysitting services added to Arcadia or Aurora.
Ah, okay. So it's not becoming like their family-focused ships, Iona or Arbia.
Exactly. They'll offer things like all-ages entertainment options, kids' menus in the restaurants, maybe some basic amenities like bottle warmers. But they're deliberately not retrofitting full-scale youth facilities.
So families are welcome, but the onboard experience will still feel quite different from a ship designed for kids from the keel up.
That seems to be the strategy. It keeps the ships distinct, perhaps appealing to families looking for a less kid-centric cruise, but it's a really important detail for parents to know. Manage expectations.
Absolutely critical distinction. And what about people who already booked these ships because they were adults only, maybe booked way in advance?
P&O's being proactive there. They're offering passengers on affected sailings the choice of a full refund, or they can switch to a different adults-only cruise without penalty.
Good. Is there a deadline for that?
Yes. Passengers need to let P&O know by December 1st, 2025. So they have time to adjust their plans. It shows they're aware this is a big shift for their loyal base.
Right. Trying to balance adapting to new markets with respecting their existing customers. Okay, quite a range today.
All right.
From future fuels to new thrills to changing demographics.
It really covers the spectrum, doesn't it? What ties it together, I think, is investment. Huge investment in the future. The tech for decarbonization.
Billions there.
And also investment in adapting now. New hardware like Legend of the Seas to capture excitement. And strategic fleet adjustments like P&O's move.
Yeah.
Reacting to how people want to travel today. It's all about staying relevant and viable long term.
It definitely highlights that tension between the long term green goals and the immediate need to attract passengers and manage costs today.
Exactly. The technology, the market demands, the economic pressures, they're all shaping the cruise experience in real time.
It leaves you with a thought, doesn't it? Considering how massive the challenges are for scaling up things like bio-LNG or hydrogen, the cost, the global infrastructure needed.
Yeah, those are decades-long projects.
So could it be that the immediate gains from digitalization, just making ships smarter and more efficient right now, actually become the most critical competitive advantage for cruise lines over, say, the next 5 years? Something for you to think about.
Thanks for listening to Cruise News. Visit cruisenews.io to catch up on the latest updates and sign up for free email alerts.